is a kind of actually losing your life or precious life for a special goal, which has a lot of benefit to other people. And one another thing that I want to tell you is that Islam views a martyr as a man or woman who dies while conducting jihad. You know that. So I think the difference between this word, this precious word of martyr, and suicide is the goal behind them. So if you're gonna go through a death of someone and you wanna just evaluate it, whether it is, worthy to be called a martyr or not, you have to go through the goal behind this actually death. And this is the actual and the important part of this discussion, in my opinion. When you go through something and you're sure to, you are sure that if you lose your life, you will save other people's lives, and you know it will benefit most of the people. This is the meaning of martyrdom, I think. So I was just wanted to clarify the meaning of martyrdom, then just tell my own idea about this topic. You know what? I think there are many people in this world that want to change this world in a better way, actually, to a more developed world, actually. So everybody will choose a way, no matter which kind of way. Someone wants to change this world by living. When you live and you suffer, and this suffering will somehow benefit other people, this is a way of jihad. And the other part of it is dying, actually. When you die for a special value that you evaluate in your life, it means that you mean something. Your death means something.
Mm-hmm.
And this exactly. is my opinion about this actually topic.
Now, Sister Bita just mentioned jihad. Let's clarify that for the audience. Mm-hmm. If Sister Zainab helps me with that, I would pretty much like that. Well, jihad to us is defined as a war in which a group of people are going to go in the intention of saving other people's lives. And they're going to fight for the truth.
Yes, Sister Asma, that was exactly what I wanted to say. You know, you talked about the one aspect of seeing life as going and participating in war as something quite useless and resembling suicide.
Mm-hmm.
That might be true. In fact, in general, when you are faithless.
Exactly.
Yes. So when you are faithless, you believe that you come to this world, you are supposed to live your life to the fullest and take advantage of it, and then you will die and you will finish. You will just lose whatever you had. But in case you are a religious person, in case you believe in God, the whole story differs. You are supposed to gather or conduct good deeds, be a good person, in order to go and live in another world, in another life, the hereafter, in peace and happiness. What sets a difference between suicide and martyrdom is the intention behind it.
Exactly.
The person who goes and participates in war has this belief in his or her mind that I'm going for the sake of Allah.
Yeah.
I'm going to participate in the war. I'm leaving my family, my mother, my wife, my
happiness
children.
And prosperity.
Yes, the most precious thing that a person has is his or her life.
Definitely.
I'm going to give my life for the sake of Allah.
That is very true.
So that is the intention. When you commit suicide, you just are aware that you are putting an end to your life. And in martyrdom, that is just the same, in the same way somehow. You mm-hmm. are aware that you're participating in a war. But the difference, as I said, is just the intention that you have.
Mm-hmm. So, dear listeners, we're talking about martyrdom. We are actually telling, differentiating between martyrdom and the suicide mission that some people would like to attach it to martyrdom. Let's go for a short break and we'll be back after no time.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back, dear listeners. This is Back to Reality. We were talking about martyrdom. We said that up until now, what I got from the guest's point of view going to a war with the intention that Allah will be satisfied with what I'm doing, and I'm fighting for truth, and I'm doing this because I want plenty much of people to be saved from the actual danger that is heading toward them. This is the intention of martyrdom. And one person, one man, one woman, they are going to sacrifice their own souls for the benefit of other people, other members of their nation. So now we continue the discussion, and let's have more on the differentiation between martyrdom and suicide.
Of course. You know, supporting the beautiful idea of my sister Zainab, I want to tell you that this martyrdom actually is not limited to battlefield. You know, it's so wider and so, you know, vaster than what you think. For example, as you know, the COVID-19 was a disaster that, you know, influenced the lives of most of the people around the world. And one of the impact of this actually virus was the martyrdom of many precious doctors and nurses and medical actually service in the hospitals around the world, not only in Islamic countries or something. There were many doctors around the world, despite their religions, that sacrificed their lives to save other people. And I think this means something actually in this topic. And I want to tell you that when someone commits suicide, it's like, you know, you are numb about anything in this life. You don't have any value, and you want to end your life to just not to take the responsibility of all the burdens in this life. You know what? Mm-hmm. And I think when someone commits suicide, this is the end of selfishness. You have to be so selfish to commit suicide, in my opinion. And this is the opposite.
While the martyrs are just selfless people.
Exactly. And this is the opposite point of martyrdom. When you will be a martyr in your life, it means that you sacrifice your life. At the same time, you know that how precious your life is.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you want to sacrifice it to save other people. And this means actually the pure kindness in human beings. And
selflessness, devotion, kindness, whatever, and that is all related to humanity, you know?
Yeah.
Because if you do not have that essence in you, the essence of true humanity, then you would never put your life in your hand and go sacrifice it when many people might call it suicide. Yeah. Now, Sister Zainab, what happens? Let's sit in the eyes of those who call it suicide. Why do they call it this way?
You know, because I think they don't have the understanding that religion gives a person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you are faithless, when you do not believe in religion, and as I said, when you do not believe in the hereafter and the other world, so you are supposed to live your life. So what should you put an end to it? You know, that makes it quite meaningless for them. But, you know, another aspect to view martyrdom is they emphasize that a religion and Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts on the concepts of justice and truth and the importance of seeking these concepts for human beings, even at the cost of their lives.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is what gives meaning, putting aside that concept of intention for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, for God's sake, this beautiful concept of truth and, you know, justice, which is so worthy in our religion. And this concept that we are going and sacrificing our lives for is quite meaningless for those countries who do not have faith. So you can see that it's quite interesting for me, and it's quite deep. You know, it's a deep point of view that exists in Islam, and we should be grateful of it.
Martyrdom is not going to be restricted to battlefields. The thing that differentiates being martyred and being trapped in a suicide machine is the intention and the creed that we have. Because when you do something in the intention that God would be satisfied with what I'm doing, and then I'm saving an entire nation, would change the whole story and turn it into something valuable. So no matter what propagandas will do, no matter what media is going to spread all over the world, no matter how much wrong notions we can see and hear nowadays, there are some men and women who sacrifice their lives for the benefit of other people in order to save an entire nation, in order to save plenty much of people who do not have any relation with them even sometimes. And as Bita just put it, sometimes it happens that a group of people like doctors, like, I don't know, even maybe engineers, if something wrong happens with the cities, then they would have to go and sacrifice their lives for the benefit of others. And I guess that is the core of our existence. That is the core of our being. We do not kill ourselves for the sheer fun of getting killed. Nobody with no true mind or brain would do that. Of course, the one who's getting into those battlefields, into those wars, has got a creed, has got a way of thinking, has got some very much deep beliefs that would take them into sacrificing their life, which is the dearest thing a person can have. So, this was all the time that we had for today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell and may Allah shower you with His blessings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
On Wednesday, Italy's new far-right-led government of Giorgia Meloni won a confidence vote in the Senate with 115 votes in favour, 79 against and 5 abstentions. The new executive can now get down to business. Meloni, aged 45, is the leader and one of the founders of Brothers of Italy, the party that spearheaded a right-wing coalition to victory in Italy last month's election.
Among the many weights I have on my shoulders today is the fact that I am the first woman ever to lead this nation as Prime Minister.
During Tuesday's first speech in the Chamber of Deputies, Meloni had presented a political program which aims as a priority to counter soaring energy bills and a looming recession. Among the main measures to take away are plans to introduce tax cuts, lift limits on cash transactions, taxing the excess profits of the energy giants in a windfall tax, and reallocating some of the EU pandemic recovery funds.
Ma la nostra priorità.
Our priority today must be to curb high energy prices and accelerate in every way the diversification of supply sources and domestic production. The context in which the government will have to act is very complicated, perhaps the most difficult since the World War II.
Also on Wednesday, Meloni went on saying that Italy will remain an active member of the EU on her watch and that it would continue to be a reliable partner of NATO in supporting Ukraine. Italy's new prime minister said that the only way to facilitate a peace deal between Russia and Ukraine is helping Kyiv to defend itself militarily. Meloni's two main allies, media magnate Silvio Berlusconi and League leader Matteo Salvini, are longtime admirers of Russian President Vladimir Putin. U.S. Embassy Chargé d'Affaires attended in person the confidence vote on Giorgia Meloni's new government at the Chamber of Deputies on Tuesday. Some fear Meloni could embark on a course of confrontation towards the Western alliance. Back in 2016, Meloni defined the European Union as rotten to its core, while in 2014, Italy's new prime minister staunchly opposed sanctions against Russia, after its annexation of Crimea.
Yemen's Ansarullah movement is doubling down on its threats to target foreign cargo ships attempting to enter Yemeni waters illegally to steal oil and other natural resources. This after the government recently fired warning shots toward a Greek oil ship attempting to illegally load an estimated 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil from a port terminal in the province of Hadramaut. The warning shots forced the Greek cargo ship to abandon its mission and use its own fuel to head back home empty-handed.
This fuel ship was attempting to steal 2 million barrels of Yemeni oil worth millions of dollars. This money is supposed to be allocated to the Central Bank of Yemen, which would then be distributed to pay labor salaries across the country. Unfortunately, this money was transferred to a bank belonging to the Saudi royal family and was used to fund the American-Saudi aggression on Yemen.
According to the government in Sana'a, ending years of plundering and looting of the Yemeni natural wealth is essential to stimulate the Yemeni economy. It also pulls Yemen out of the decades of poverty and economic instability, which has already left millions of Yemenis in poverty, an initiative the Sana'a government says is promising to make it a reality. Observers believe that the world now needs to recognize that it is dealing with a new Yemeni nation, one that will never compromise its dignity and sovereignty.
The new identity of Yemen is because people's demands are now being met, whereby the Yemeni people are finally getting what they deserve as they reap the benefit of their natural resources, which used to be exploited and plundered. The latest warning shots we sent are an example of the military and political leadership's strengths, pose, and determination to protect the people of Yemen.
Yemen has for decades been described as the poorest country in the Middle East. However, the underlying reasons why that is the case are hardly ever discussed. According to experts we spoke with, one of the main reasons is the systematic exploitation of Yemen's natural wealth by the UAE and Saudi Arabia.
With the latest developments, foreign countries and companies who have a history in plundering Yemen's natural resources will have to think twice about entering the country's waters illegally, as the Ansarullah movement has made it very clear it will not hesitate to use decisive military force to protect what it calls the Yemeni people's wealth. Yusuf Mawadi, Sana'a.
During his first speech as British Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak used the occasion to issue a call for unity. Sunak must find a way to quickly unite not just a bitterly divided Conservative Party, but also a deeply troubled nation. However, he also issued warnings of difficult times ahead.
I will place economic stability and confidence at the heart of this government's agenda. This will mean difficult decisions to come.
The Prime Minister has inherited a country in crisis. Energy prices are high, cost of living through the roof, and millions of Brits are expected to struggle this winter. Another worry for Sunak, Conservative Party popularity has plummeted in recent months, sitting approximately 30 points behind the opposition Labour Party. Sunak's supporters say he's economically experienced from his days as Chancellor and praised Sunak as Britain's youngest leader in 200 years and the first ever non-white leader. But his critics claim that's just not enough.
He definitely has the credentials, he definitely has the experience, been there in the, as Chancellor before. But again, we need to understand, you know, where does he sit right here, right now, with everyday voters? He has not been elected by the people, as well as he. Most people feel that he cannot resonate with the ones that are struggling. I'm not sure if it is real representation for anyone of a minority background, especially when he comes from a very, very elitist club, and he does not really represent many. He's probably top 1% of majority of brown people or Asians, whatever you want to call it, in the entire world. So it's very difficult to sort of resonate and feel sort of you know, close in that way.
Many challenges lie ahead for the new Prime Minister, in particular how he's going to overcome Britain's many economic crises. However, even if he does find a way to overcome Britain's economic woes, question marks still remain surrounding if he has what it takes to win the Conservatives the next general election. Robert Carter, London.
NGC 23 is a remote galaxy which is more than 200 million light-years away from Earth. What's even more interesting is that the interstellar object was observed by none of the celebrity telescopes like James Webb, but by a new indigenous Iranian observatory called INO, short for Iranian National Observatory, marking a milestone in the country's quest for deep space.
Within 3 weeks ago, which we got the first light, the so-called first light, we had no idea about the quality of the image we are going to get, and it was excellent.
Another debut image shot by the 3.4-meter optical telescope is ARP-282, an interacting galaxy pair located approximately 320 million light-years away. Scientists at the Iranian National Observatory say their telescope could see objects as far as 7 billion light-years away.
Of course, we can use this telescope to observe even deeper objects, but the highest quality of this telescope can be achieved up to 7 billion light-years away from us.
INO is built on Mount Gargash, north of the city of Isfahan, at a height of 3,600 meters above sea level. The project was initiated about 15 years ago, aiming at the development of a medium-class telescope to provide a research facility for national users.
In the next coming months, and especially in the next year, the telescope will be delivered to the astronomers as the end user of this expensive and complex instrument.
Constructing INO was the result of complicated scientific and technological efforts, but there was even a tougher challenge, U.S. sanctions. The anti-Iran measures block high-tech imports and access to foreign know-how. The Iranian team purchased the glass mirror blanks from a German firm, but then had to figure out how to construct nearly everything else on their own.
Due to U.S. sanctions and some financial problems, they cut their relation with us, and we did the rest of project within last 12 years by ourselves.
INO is still not fully developed. Engineers need to integrate software, fine-tune the active optics, and install the first science instrument, a high-resolution imaging camera. Once completed, the telescope will help scientists understand galaxy formation and stellar evolution and hunt for exoplanets.
With INO, Iran has marked its first giant leap in space exploration and has fairly entered the world space race. The telescope's builders are now thrilled to announce that they will soon release more stunning images of deep space, hoping to help the world catch a glimpse of the wonders of our universe. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Thousands of mourners took to the streets of Nablus in the occupied West Bank to bid farewell to Palestinians killed by Israeli forces. Early Tuesday, clashes broke out between Palestinian fighters and Israeli forces after regime forces conducted a raid in Nablus. Several Palestinians were killed in the raid. Among the victims was Wadi Hawah, a fighter for the newly formed resistance group Lion's Den. 21 other Palestinians were also wounded in the attack, some of them in critical condition.
Those Palestinian young men will not be defeated by the Israeli war machinery. The Israeli occupation will pay a high price for its crimes. The response will be in the field. The flag of Wadi Hawa and other martyrs will continue flying every day, and more Palestinian heroes will be born.
The Israeli army said it had carried out a vast operation with police and intelligence officers targeting a site used by the main operatives of the Lion's Den, describing it as a headquarters and a workshop for making weapons. Later on Tuesday, regime forces conducted another attack near Ramallah and killed one more Palestinian man. 19-year-old Qusay At-Tamimi was killed during a confrontation in the village of Nabi Saleh. Palestinian officials have condemned the raids as vicious and criminal, but they said such attacks will not break the will of the Palestinian people, who are adherent to resistance as their legitimate right.
Their attacks on Palestinians in Nablus and in Ramallah and in other places will not break the Palestinian will. It will not stop the Palestinian resistance. The Palestinians have understood very clearly that Israel understands only the language of force, and that's why they are ready to defend themselves and defend their rights.
All the Palestinians are in the same tunnel, facing the same atrocities, while the same war crimes are being committed all over the Palestinian territories. The Palestinians are unified through different forms of resistance.
Since the beginning of this year, over 130 Palestinians have been killed in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds.
The Israeli regime threatens to continue killing Palestinian resistance fighters under the pretext of battling terrorism. Palestinians, however, say they will remain steadfast in their resolve, stressing that the Israeli atrocities will not stop their resistance. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The 18th General Assembly of the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies gathered up members of the media entity in Tehran to discuss new trends in news production and explore areas of cooperation between its members.
So basically, OANA has now become somewhat of a center of world-balanced approach to journalism. Nowadays, it's quite difficult to find media companies outside of Asia and Africa who are looking for a balanced approach to news. Basically, a lot of the major media companies of the world have decided to play only for one side.
I'm from Lebanon's state news agency. I believe this summit provides a platform for media diplomacy between the member news agencies to reach common grounds on world affairs.
OANA currently has 43 members from 35 countries, covering two-thirds of the world population. As a member, the Islamic Republic News Agency, or shortly IRNA, is hosting this year's General Assembly, based on a voting that took place during the 17th OANA Summit in Seoul, South Korea.
Today is a good opportunity for the representatives of prominent news agencies present in Tehran for the OANA meeting to observe the conditions in Iran. An independent media current is needed to disseminate the realities.
Formed in 1961 on UNESCO's initiative, the Organization of Asia-Pacific News Agencies is an association of news agencies from UNESCO member states in the Asia-Pacific region. OANA provides a newswire service containing articles provided by its members. Aside from IRNA, Iran's Fars News and Mehr News agencies are also among OANA members.
Delegates here say OANA's main goal is to break the Western monopoly on media and to present an alternative narrative on regional and global developments, as opposed to, quote, the narrative offered by mainstream media. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The Russian flag now flies over Donetsk, as Russia claims this region is now part of the Russian Federation. The streets in the center are quiet as Ukraine continues to bomb the city. The front line is only 6 kilometers away. In order to find out how people here feel about their new identity, I headed down the road to the adjoining city of Makiivka. There are more people on the streets, as it's safer here.
We are very happy. We've been waiting for it for a long time. We're very glad. All acquaintances, neighbors, all people surrounding me are grateful to Russia.
It's a complicated question. After everything that's been going on, it can be no other way now. There is no other way but to be with Russia. We were close people always. We couldn't be divided. We lived quite okay in Ukraine, but it's no longer Ukraine. Their authorities are not Ukrainian anymore.
This is a common sentiment in Donbass, that they were happy being part of Ukraine, but when the nationalists came to power in 2014 and began discriminating against Russian culture and bombing civilians here, they turned toward Russia.
We have been waiting for it. Donbass was eager to become part of Russia. We have the same values, culture, and now that we are part of Russia, we can be ourselves. I'll tell the truth. While they've been shelling us and we were living in fear, in Kiev, they were enjoying themselves. Nobody in Kiev paid any attention. There are people there who support and understand us, but they cannot speak about it. They can be killed or imprisoned by the SBU for this. We're not against Ukrainian civilians. We are Ukrainian people too. I have relatives there. We have pity for people in Kiev, but nobody's killing them there on purpose.
Thousands have been killed by Ukrainian shelling over the last 8 years here. Hardly a day goes by without more civilians dying. Most of the anger I hear, though, is directed at the Ukrainian government, not its people.
I sympathize with them very much. I am always against people being killed, but it's war. Nothing can be done about it. They're killing us and we have to defend ourselves. Sometimes we had to hide in basements because of shelling. I work at school. Our school was under shelling. The windows were smashed. It's very scary.
Now, doing vox pops in cities on issues around the world, you usually get a variety of opinions. Not so here. Everybody I've spoken to says they want to join Russia. The only difference of opinion seems to be just how much sympathy they have for people in Kiev now living under shelling themselves. The people here have been doing so for the last 8 years. While the southern regions of Zaporozhye and Kherson are more mixed, for peace to come, it's clear the world needs to accept that the vast majority of people in Donbass no longer want to be part of Ukraine. Jenny Miller, Donbass.
It's taken him a few weeks longer than anticipated, but former Chancellor Rishi Sunak is now the leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister-elect of the UK, and of course, the first ethnic minority to hold either position. In a rather stage-managed affair, Sunak made his first public address to the nation.
But there is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity, and I will make it my utmost priority to bring our party and our country together. Rishi,
you have raised... Sunak had been the favoured candidate with fellow MPs in the leadership contest held in the summer, but had to settle for runner-up spot. This after Liz Truss won the vote of the Tory party members. This time, MPs saw to it that this was an internal matter, with voters looking on as yet another Conservative MP was anointed.
We had Johnston, we had Liz Truss very briefly, and now we have Sunak. Ordinary people in Britain have got no say over who becomes Prime Minister. That is a democratic deficit, and I think it sticks in the throats of many, many people in this country.
Sunak was keen to emphasise unity and stability, but those might be wishful ideas for a party that's literally at war with itself.
But there's been so much infighting within inside the Conservative Party, it's very difficult to see how they can all just lay down their knives and be friends again. Now, obviously, the sight of Labour running well ahead in the opinion polls will unite them. They're not lemmings, they don't want to commit suicide. That's why there won't be an election soon.
Prime Minister. Sunak's leadership will be tested by the presence of figures like former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, who claimed to have had the support to run for high office, but conceded now was not the right time for his return. How can Sunak ensure he doesn't follow the Liz Truss path to political collapse?
For many, the British premiership is a poison chalice. With the country facing one of the worst cost of living crises in a generation, with, of course, more austerity measures bound to be implemented and a political landscape more divided than ever, the new occupants of Downing Street face a Herculean task to try and pull Britain back from the brink.
Amina Taylor, London.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Divisions within the UK Tory party are much more intense than those within other conservative parties in the West. In this regard, we have taken a look at some world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for the first part, please. RT in an op-ed wrote, like many Western conservative parties, the Tories are going through a period of deep division. Liz Truss was finally compelled to resign as UK Prime Minister late last week. The radical new era that she had promised to usher in had lasted a mere 45 days. Her downfall came as no surprise to observers of UK politics. Weeks ago, George Galloway told all who would listen that Truss was as thick as mince in a bottle, as the historian Dominic Sandbrook said she was the least impressive person to have become Prime Minister in my lifetime. So it proved to be. Truss's cabinet was no better. Last week, Tory MP Charles Walker described them as talentless people, a charitable assessment under the circumstances. Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng proved to be just as inept as Truss, as there are simply no words at all to adequately describe Truss's Deputy Prime Minister Therese Coffey. Truss's exit from politics has only intensified the self-destructive divisions within the UK Tory party that caused Remainers and other elements of the party to depose Boris Johnson earlier this year. The crisis that is destroying the Tory party intensified dramatically on Sunday night when Johnson announced that he would not be a candidate in the Tory leadership contest, saying that you can't govern effectively unless you have a united party in Parliament. How did the Tory party come to be in the extraordinary position it now finds itself, crippled by internal divisions, completely bereft of competent leadership, internally ungovernable, and facing electoral annihilation at the next general election, whenever that may be held? The answer, in large part, lies in the economic revolution that has occurred in the global economy over the past 40 years. This revolution, which is still in progress, involves the transformation of the international economic order from one based on nation-states, industrial production, and fossil fuels, to one based on global corporations, new technologies, and renewable energy sources. This economic revolution, as radically transformative as the first industrial revolution, has been led by a new set of global ruling elites who are rapidly replacing the older nation-state-based elites that had controlled the world order since the end of Second World War, if not before. As all revolutionary elites do, the new global elites formulate ideologies that legitimize the new economic and social order that they are creating. These include globalism, catastrophic climate change, identity politics, all forms of political correctness, and most recently, gender fluidity and rights. These new ideologies stand in stark contrast to those adhered to by the older nation-state-based elites. They believed in what used to be called traditional 19th century bourgeois values, including nationalism, patriotism, the traditional family, individual rights, the rule of law, Christianity, and work ethic. As the new global economic order and its rulers have progressively displaced the older economic system and its leaders, these antithetical ideologies have clashed with increasing bitterness and intensity. This ongoing conflict has been termed the culture wars by some historians. This clash of irreconcilable ideologies is still taking place in all Western nations. The precise form that it takes differs in each country, depending upon the history and cultural characteristics of each. At the same time, that economies and ideological beliefs in the West have undergone profound revolutionary change over the past 40 years. Politics in liberal democracies have also been fundamentally transformed. In Western countries with two-party political systems, left-wing social democratic parties that once represented the interests of the industrial working class and middle-class progressives have now become parties representing the interests of the new globalized elites. Blair's Labour Party and Clinton's Democratic Party are classic examples of this transformation, which often involves a degree of conflict. Hence, Keir Starmer's recent battle with Jeremy Corbyn, who represented the old Labour Party, and Hillary Clinton's conflict with Bernie Sanders, who is an old-style democratic socialist. In Australia, the Labour Party has seamlessly made this transition in recent years. Once social democratic parties complete this kind of political transformation, they become ideologically unified to an extraordinary degree because they rigidly adhere to the beliefs of the new elites. Policy differences continue to exist, but deep-seated divisions disappear entirely. The UK Labour Party, for example, contains no equivalent of Tory culture warriors like Kemi Badenoch. With traditional Conservative parties, however, the situation is very different. These parties tend to be unstable mixes of old and new elites because their economic interests coincide to a considerable degree. Many members of the old guard readily adapt themselves to the new global economic regime, in the same way that a significant segment of the 18th century French aristocracy sided with the bourgeoisie when the French Revolution broke out. But while elements of the old elites may easily adapt to the new global economic order, many find it much more difficult to adapt the ideological beliefs that are part and parcel of that economic order. Significant segments of conservative parties still represent the interests of the older elites, and more importantly, still firmly believe in traditional 19th century bourgeois values. That is why the ideological divisions within the conservative parties tend to be much more intense. Hence, why the ongoing bitter conflicts within the Tory party over Brexit, climate change, identity policies, and other rights, all key cultural walls issues, simply have no counterpart within the UK Labour Party. Divisions within the UK Tory party are much more intense than those within other conservative parties in the West, because only in the UK did the autonomy of the nation-state itself become a political issue. Because of former Tory PM David Cameron's disastrous decision to hold a referendum on Brexit. In America, since 1990s, the traditional Republican Party has transformed itself from a conservative party into a right-wing populist party controlled by Donald Trump that appeals to the older middle class and the traditional working class, which have been economically displaced by the new global economic order and abandoned politically by the Democrats. Where then does this leave the UK Tory party? A few things are tolerably clear. First, a Trump-style populist transformation of the Tory party in England was never on the cards. If a right-wing populist party is to emerge in the UK, it can only do so after the Conservative Party has ceased to exist. And second, the deep ideological divisions that have reduced it to a shambles are so deep-seated that they cannot be eradicated. Even Truss' embarrassing demise has not convinced her supporters. The rabid neoliberals that her policies were fundamentally flawed. The remainer wing of the party that was instrumental in deposing Johnson remains unrepentant, as do the right-wing culture warriors led by Badenoch. Also, Truth Out wrote, as so often in recent times, the Tory party has a new leader and therefore Britain a new prime minister. In the last leadership contest, Rishi Sunak managed to lose to the inept ideologue Liz Truss, who then, only weeks later, when challenged by a tabloid newspaper to add last a lettuce last to the vegetable. How did the political script twist into this farce? How could former Prime Minister Boris Johnson, a figure so disgraced that he should be auditioning for pantomime villain roles in the run-up to Christmas, countenance a comeback, and why did he fall short? Why is Sunak so despised in the Tory party, and how did he nonetheless carry the day? What does his government represent, and how will the Labour Party respond? The trigger came when Truss government attempt a Reagan-style borrowing binge. Truss was not the choice of her fellow Tory members of parliament. Since 2001, a voice in some Tory leadership contest has been granted to party members. Their demographic is distinctive, small in number, overwhelmingly old, white, male, bigoted, middle-class residents of southern England. In a word, out of touch. Their ideal, Truss, promised Reaganite tax cuts for the wealthy plus Johnson style. Cake is populism. When it comes to cake, he is pro having it and pro eating it too. All this in a period of a stagnation when central banks were raising interest rates. The sums didn't add up. Truss lost the support of capital in shape most immediately of currency and gilt traders. Sterling slumped to a record low against the dollar and the price of government debt soared. The fracture between capital and the party of capital under Truss had begun earlier. In the slipstream of 2008 Great Recession, the 2010s were years of despair and polarization. The rich were greatly enriched thanks to quantitative easing. Everyone else was subjected to austerity. Wages flatlined or declined and have still not recovered.
Seven barometric pressure.
We come to you, and oh God, knowing that thou art our only King.
You're listening to the program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with Brother Yasser Ibrahim.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasser Ibrahim. One of the matters, or rather critiques, that have been laid against the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, or the Shia in general, is that, you know, it is a sect that has been created, it is not academic, and all sorts of other, you know, insults that have been thrown at the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, that they have nothing, there is just, it's more like a cult, it is not, it's anything to do with Islam. And obviously, when these accusations and these insults were thrown, the scholars, the great scholars of Islam, the great scholars of the Madhab and the Shi'i school of thought, the followers of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam, took it upon themselves to answer these particular critiques, accusations, and, you know, there's nothing else to say than these insults by those who are ignorant of the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam. And one of those scholars will be mentioned today, and the scholar who we will mention, and one of his books that we will mention, was a person who personally took it upon himself to answer these, you know, accusations. And he showed, yes, there may be some exaggeration in what he writes, but he shows that, you know, the Shia and the school of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam is not only full of writings, of scholars, of academia, of the promotion of knowledge and ilm, but they were at the forefront of it. The students of the imams themselves. You don't say that the school of Ahl al-Bayt has nothing. No, the school of Ahl al-Bayt has more than can be counted. So inshallah, in our next segment, the book and the author of this will be introduced to our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio. As we mentioned in our previous segment, that, you know, the school of Ahlul Bayt, alayhi wasalam, the school of the followers of the family of Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, has had many an accusation thrown at it. And one of it is that it has nothing. What has it produced? It is a cult than more than anything else. So one of those scholars who took it upon himself to answer this particular accusation and insult that has been thrown at the school of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhim as-salam, is the great Sayyid, the great scholar, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, rahmatullah alayh. Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr has two important books on this issue. One is the one that we will be introducing today and the one that has been translated into English, obviously. The other one, I am not sure if it has been translated into English or not. So this book that is, whose title has been translated as The Shia and Islamic Disciplines. It is a translation of the original Arabic that is Al-Shia wal-Funun al-Islam. This is the original title of the Arabic book, again, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr. And it was translated by Brother Umar Kumo and published by the World Ahlul Bayt, or the Ahlul Bayt World Assembly, and published in the year 2012 in the city of Qom in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So a little bit about the author. So the author, Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, was born in Qadhimiyyah. The Sadr family, majority of them were from Qadhimiyyah, which can be considered to be Baghdad in current-day Iraq. But he's more famously known for his studies in Najaf and the teachings of fiqh and usul that he produced in Najaf, and more importantly, these books that he wrote to show that the school of Ahlul Bayt is not only rich in terms of scholars, in terms of writings, in terms of producing knowledge, but they were at the forefront of it. In this book, for example, he aims to show that even in the Islamic disciplines, for example, hadith, for example, fiqh or jurisprudence, for example, the principles of jurisprudence or usul, and so on and so forth, these Shia scholars were at the forefront of these principles, or rather these disciplines. And he shows with examples and the scholars who wrote and the methodology that they used about it. And inshallah, we will read for the benefit of our dear listeners a part of this book, as we always do, on this particular subject, or from the particular book itself. So anyway, we will just read a small portion of this book from the preface written by the author himself, where he says that I will close this preface with a word of gratitude to the Honorable Brother Al-Murtada Al-Ridawi, the director of Al-Najjah Bookshop in Najaf, Republic of Iraq. So obviously the book was written in Iraq, for his meritorious efforts in disseminating knowledge and exposing its hidden treasures, and for the opportunity he gave me to peruse this invaluable book. I am sure when the new edition reaches the hands of scholars, it will be a subject for serious research by the will of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So this is the end of the preface of, or the last paragraph that written in the preface, show that the book was written in Najaf by this great scholar. And hopefully, inshallah, in our next segment, we will be reading a portion of the book for our dear listeners and for the benefit of our dear listeners. So please stay tuned.
Sacred texts we have received to help us understand where we came from and where we are going as a human race are most rich in helping us find our direction. They narrate stories of our past, but where have they brought us? Where are their messages now? Are we the people of belief, or have we become the people of the boxes? Is there wisdom trapped in our bookshelves? Bookshelves, bookshelves, bookshelves.
Welcome back, dear listeners, to our program Bookshelf on IRIB English Radio with me, Brother Yasir Ibrahim. The book that we introduce to our dear listeners is titled The Shia and Islamic Disciplines, written by the great Sayyid Hassan al-Sadr, Rahmatullah Alayh, translated by Brother Umar Kumo, and published by the Ahlul Bayt Wal Assembly in Iran. So obviously, the first chapter of this book, as we mentioned, the book is a book that deals with the Islamic disciplines and the, you know, precedence and the forwardness of the Shia in the Islamic sciences and in the Islamic disciplines. And what is amazing and what is, you know, more appropriate is that Sayyid Sadr begins the book with the Quranic sciences. Obviously, the Quran being the most important book for Muslims and for within Islam. So, chapter 1, the precedence of the Shia in Quranic sciences. This chapter comprises several sections, but it is necessary to note that the commander of the faithful, Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, was the first to classify Quranic sciences. He dictated 60 categories thereof, illustrating each through an example. This is found in a book which we relate on his authority through several chains of narration. It is the first source for all that is subsequently written on Quranic sciences. We still have a copy of this book. The first compilation of the whole Quran in the canonical order of revelation, which was done after the Prophet's demise, is that of the commander of the faithful, Ali, peace be upon him. The narrations that came transmitted, the narrations that came down to us from the household, from the household of the Prophet, to that effect are widely transmitted, mutawatira. While the Sunnis report in this respect are extensive, mustafida. We have cited some of them and have reviewed Ibn Hajar Asqalani's view in the unabridged version. We ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to enable us to truly understand the Islamic sciences and for us to become more acquainted with these Islamic sciences, and more importantly, the precedence of the scholars from the school of Ahlul Bayt and Islam within these particular sciences. Inshallah, until next time, my dear brothers and sisters. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Bookshelf with Brother Yasir Ibrahim on RIB English Radio.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.